True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
There's no question that Michael Dunn shot and killed 17-year-old Jordan Russell Davis. Tommy Storns, Jordan's friend, who was driving the car that Jordan was in, acted quickly, backing his car away as Michael Dunn shot into the vehicle. Jordan's murder is often referred to as the loud music case because the incident began when Michael Dunn asked the teens to turn down their stereo. According to Dunn, Jordan threatened to kill him, opening his car door and pointing a shotgun at him. Dunn had a concealed weapons permit. He retrieved his handgun from his glove compartment and fired at Davis. He shot 10 times. Then he fled the scene, went to a hotel with his fiancée, and ordered a pizza. Tommy Storns drove his SUV away to a nearby parking lot. Jordan was gasping for air. Jordan died that night. Michael Dunn was arrested at his home the next day. The trial of Michael Dunn for murder brought attention to Florida's Stand Your Ground law as he claimed self-defense. If he could prove that he felt like his life was being threatened, he had no obligation to retreat. Of course, racism is also an issue here. Michael Dunn is a middle-aged white man, and Jordan was an African-American teen. Dunn was overheard remarking about thug music. Our discussion today, Trigger Happy, The Murder of Jordan Davis, surrounds the events leading up to and following the shooting and the trial of Michael Dunn, who really seemed to know no remorse after he claimed self-defense without any evidence of a threat. With the conviction of Michael Dunn, we know that Black lives do matter, but are African-American teens any safer today because of the court's decision? And I wonder about this Stand Your Ground law. Does this give people a license to kill? These are the topics we'll address.
So for my beer today, I chose one called Last Buffalo in the Park, which is brewed by Funky Buddha Brewing in Oakland Park, Florida. Now, it's an American porter that's barrel-aged. Quite a wonderful beer. Pitch black in color. Looks kind of thick and viscous. There's no real head to it at all. So just sitting there, this black oily mess. Yeah, it's not a mess, but that's what it is.
Sounds attractive, yeah.
So it's got an aroma of coconut and chocolate and some booze. And it tastes like that Mounds Bar stuff.
I was just going to say, right? That sounds like a Mounds Bar.
It is. And there's some bourbon, but it's not as prominent as you would think from the aroma. This is a medium-bodied, very smooth, easy-to-drink beer. Got to be careful because it is 11.5% alcohol by volume, so you don't want to be slugging these down either. But these guys, this brewery, Funky Buddha, makes some really world-class beers.
Yeah, you've reviewed some of their beers before, right? It sounds very familiar.
I have. And I think when we hit Florida in a couple of weeks, we'll have to stop by there and pick up some beers.
Florida seems to have some pretty good breweries.
They do.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Good. Okay. Well, let's open that beer and we'll head down to the quiet end.
Let's go down there.
All right, Dick. Now, as we sit here at the quiet end, I'm looking over at one of these high top tables. So be discreet, but look at this couple right next to us. It looks like a first date, possibly like a Match.com internet meetup.
Yeah, they don't look like they quite go together.
No.
But they do seem to be having a pretty good time.
Oh, Dickie, you don't get the vibes.
You do?
I have the vibe that
okay. I mean,
she's not happy.
I'm just looking, and it seems like for a first date, if that's what it is, it looks like they're doing okay.
Well, I mean, on a first date, you're going to be friendly. What are you going to do?
You're picking up some other things, though, huh?
Well, for one thing, she keeps looking at her phone like she's checking the time.
Bad sign.
Or maybe she has someone scheduled to call her and give her an excuse, which is a smart thing to do.
It is.
She has that set up. Now, I would say that he definitely seems like he's into her, but she's a very attractive woman.
She is.
Yeah. And he's not bad looking, but a little slovenly. I hate it when women get all dressed up to go out and then the guy's in a baseball hat.
Well, that's what I was saying. They didn't look like they were well paired.
Yeah.
Know? But I still thought they were doing okay. But my wife, who knows all these things and is much more observant than I am, says, not so fast.
Yeah, I think I pay more attention to people. And there are other gifts that you have.
That's true.
Yes. But we'll see as it progresses. We'll see what happens if they leave together or if she goes running out in a few minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll try not to get distracted while we do our podcast.
I know.
Here.
Let's concentrate on the podcast because I think this is a pretty important topic we're covering today.
It is.
Yeah.
So Jordan Davis was born on February 16th, 1995, to Lucia and Ron Davis in Atlanta, Georgia. Parents later divorced and he lived in Atlanta and in Jacksonville, Florida, where his father resided. So he spent time in Atlanta with his mom and Florida with his dad. Like all of us who are parents, Jordan's parents had dreams for their son, and in an instant, his life was over. On November 23rd, 2012, the day after Thanksgiving, in Jacksonville, Jordan and his buddies were out having fun when Michael Dunn shot Jordan to death, apparently in a dispute over the loud music that was coming from their car. Jordan Davis, Leland Brunson, Tommy Storms, and Kevin Thompson stopped at the Gate gas station to buy gum and cigarettes. And they were planning on just having a quiet afternoon and evening watching videos and stuff. So while the driver, Tommy, was inside making the purchase, Michael Dunn and his fiance, Rhonda Rauer, pulled into the parking spot beside their car. Rhonda left her car to purchase white wine and chips. She testified that Dunn told her, "I hate that thug music," before she left the car for the store, although Dunn later would say he used the words rap crap and not thug music.
So what's the significance there of the phrase thug music? That's a more racist comment,
isn't it?
Is what I'm picking up.
It's a way more pejorative term.
I think so. I think thug to him was almost like the N-word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay. The teens had gone to St. John's Town Center Mall, a popular place for young people to meet up. Jordan wanted to see his girlfriend, who worked at the mall. Jordan's parents, Ron Davis and Lucia McBath, are divorced. Lucia was spending Thanksgiving in Chicago with Jordan's stepdad and relatives, but Jordan chose to stay home with his dad. Jordan had asked his dad for an advance on his allowance, and he was hoping to find some Black Friday deals at the mall. While Jordan was shopping and visiting his girlfriend, a middle-aged couple, Rhonda Rauer and Michael Dunn, were attending the wedding of Michael's son. The couple had arrived earlier that day and checked into a hotel with their new puppy. They'd driven 170 miles to be there for the wedding, and after the wedding, they left around 7 p.m., so about the same time the kids were leaving the mall. Jordan and his friends had left the mall the same time. They planned to play video games that night, but first they stopped at the Gate gas station for some gum and a pack of cigarettes. Jordan, Leland, and Tevin waited in the red SUV while Tommy went into the store. As they waited, they listened to the pounding rhythms of Beef by Chicago rapper Lil Reese. And that's the song we were playing as we began this story.
Oh, that's what that was.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. On the way back to the hotel, Michael and Rhonda pulled into the same gas station. Michael parked right next to the red SUV, which I wonder why he did that, because it's almost like he was looking for trouble.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the place was busy and there weren't other parking spots.
I don't believe so. Not from what I saw.
Okay.
If you have this loud music that you find offensive, why would you park right next to them?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So unless you kind of had to. There weren't other spots available.
Yeah, or unless he was looking for trouble.
Well, that's a whole other thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, we don't know.
They'd been to a wedding. They'd been drinking.
Right.
Maybe he was feeling pretty tough.
Well, as we'll get into later, one of his neighbors thought that he was just waiting for an excuse to use that gun. So we don't know.
Yeah.
But by all accounts, the music was at full volume. It was very loud. Rhonda went into the store to get her wine and some potato chips, and she crossed paths with Tommy Storns. Just seconds after Tommy walked out of the store, gunshots rang out from the parking lot. The red SUV backed up and raced away with Tommy behind the wheel, but the shooting continued. Now, at this time, Jacksonville 911 got a flurry of calls about this shooting. Moments after the shooting ended, both cars were gone from the lot. Police arrived and found casings on the ground and some blood. The red SUV returned just minutes later. They got Jordan out. He was on the ground, gasping for air and bleeding. His friend and police who came in started CPR until the paramedics showed up. Remarkably, Leland, Tevin, and Tommy were unharmed. They hadn't been hit.
Yeah. So Jordan had been sitting in the passenger side back seat. Three bullets entered the passenger side door and hit him. Tevin in the front seat had evaded injury because the angle of the car as it fled kept the bullets from going all the way through the door. Now, Jordan was hit three times. Turned out that one bullet entered his liver, the other a lung, and the third bullet sliced through his aorta, which would be pretty quick death.
Yeah, but any one of those shots could have been fatal. Those are vital organs.
They are.
But definitely the aorta would be quickly fatal.
Oh, you're going to bleed out pretty fast with that.
Yeah, and that's the big main artery.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Jordan's father, Ron, was called. He rushed to the hospital praying that Jordan would survive, but a doctor told Ron that they'd been unable to save Jordan. Ron was devastated, and he was stuck with the task of informing Jordan's mother. So at 10:45 that evening, Lucia's cell phone lit up. From the tone of Ron's voice, she immediately knew something was wrong with Jordan. Ron had been taken to see his son's body. He was told he couldn't touch his son because of the homicide investigation, but he disregarded that rule. Jordan looked like he was sleeping. Ron hugged him and said a heart-wrenchingly premature goodbye to his son.
So this is a horrible thing.
Yeah, you know, your kid goes out with some buddies. You're just going to hang out at the mall and goof around.
Yeah.
And you get a call from the police that he's dead.
It's the worst nightmare, right?
Isn't it?
Yeah. Now, as Jordan's parents were struggling with their loss, Jordan's friends were at the police station. Of course, they're in shock and traumatized by this shooting. They knew that Jordan had been shot, but they didn't know that he was dead. Investigators were trying to make sense of what had happened. They didn't know if the boys had threatened someone or if they had been targeted by someone. For evidence, they had the red Dodge Durango with multiple bullet holes to the passenger side and the rear of the vehicle. There were casings on the ground. Witnesses had described Michael Dunn's car, but it was no longer there. Police began to look at the case as a possible drive-by shooting, killing. Dunn's black Jetta had disappeared, and he and his fiancée were missing. Now, this is very unusual. When police come to a shooting, especially if it's supposed to be a justified shooting, in air quotes, usually the shooter is still there and traumatized and upset that they've shot someone.
I mean, he knows that, well, let me rephrase this. The shooter knew that he had done something.
Of course.
Right?
He'd shot 10 times at a vehicle with four people in it.
So wouldn't you stay around and talk to the police? I mean, it is beyond comprehension that he just gets in his car and drives away.
Makes him look guilty, doesn't it?
Well, sure.
Yeah. Leland was Jordan's best friend. He was very pale and obviously in shock. Police interviewed him along with Tevin and Tommy. They described how they'd been listening to their music as Tommy ran inside to make some purchases. Michael Dunn pulled up and asked them to turn the music down. Tevin Thompson, who was sitting in the front passenger seat, complied with the request.
Yeah, but Jordan didn't want the music turned down. He said he was tired of people telling him what to do, and he turned it back up. So then there was an exchange of words between Jordan and Michael Dunn. Tevin remembered Jordan saying, "Fuck you," to Michael Dunn. And Michael Dunn said, "Are you talking to me?" A couple of witnesses heard Dunn say, "You're not going to talk to me that way."
Yeah, so I really feel like this was a response more to disrespect than to any kind of threat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
He was just kind of being a mouthy teenager.
Yeah.
And this guy had no right to tell him what to do anyway.
Well, he didn't.
No.
But he thinks he did.
Certainly. Dunn reached into his glove box and pulled out his 9mm handgun. Right about this time, Tommy exited the store. As he was putting on his seatbelt, he looked over and saw a gun pointed at him from only about 3 feet away. The first three shots were in quick succession. But Michael Dunn didn't stop with that. He actually reloaded his gun and shot 7 more times at a car that's trying to get away. When he shot at the back of the car, a bullet hit the visor up front, and it really missed Tommy Storm, the driver's head, by mere inches. To me, it's a wonder he didn't kill all of these kids.
Well, from the video of the car and the story that's going on, yeah, he could have killed or hit all 4 of those kids.
If he hadn't pulled away, I think he would have killed them all.
Yeah, so Tommy did the right thing.
He did a good job trying to get out of there.
He tried to get out of there.
Yeah.
So as Michael's shooting, his fiancée Rhonda comes out of the store. Witnesses heard him say to Rhonda, "Get in the car." One of the witnesses who called 911 had clearly seen Michael Dunn's car, and he called in the license number. So police ran the license plate and got his name and the image of his photo ID. So Jordan's friends were shown Dunn's photo. Tevin Thompson was able to positively identify Dunn as the shooter. By 3 o'clock in the morning, they had a warrant signed. Hadn't heard from Dunn in the hours since the shooting, so he was considered on the run.
Well, yeah. News of the shooting and Jordan Davis's death was on the Florida news channels that night. Jacksonville Sheriff's detectives were out searching for Michael Dunn. Dunn had left the parking lot after the shooting. He didn't wait for the police or the ambulance. This led investigators to question his motive for the shooting. The public speculated about whether Dunn was a racist, whether he had assumed that the boys were criminals because they were black, and he'd acted out of an irrational fear, and really a complete disregard for their lives, like they're not even human beings.
Well, it sure sounds suspicious, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, he pulls in, the shooting occurs, and he takes off.
Yeah.
And then once he took off, it was almost as if nothing had happened.
Right, to go back to your hotel and walk your puppy and eat pizza. And
yeah.
I just don't know what the fiancé was thinking. That's something that perplexes me.
It's troublesome to me.
Yeah.
Although she testified correctly, as it turns out.
She did redeem herself in the end, but she did seem to be going along with him. I often wonder, was he abusive to her, at least verbally, had her kind of under his thumb?
You maybe think she was afraid of him.
I think so, maybe. He's a scary guy. Except Michael Dunn's daughter, she would say he wasn't. She would defend him. But there were others who were not completely surprised by his behavior. He was a software developer who was going through some financial difficulties, and he seemed like a bitter person. He had recently been forced to sell his plane. He was a, what do you call it, amateur pilot?
Well, he was a pilot.
He wasn't a professional pilot, I mean.
No, okay.
Well, he did it for fun. That's what I mean. It wasn't his job.
Yeah.
So he had a little plane, and he had to sell it because he couldn't afford to repair it and maintain it. Now, he'd also been estranged from his son for 5 years, despite their attending his wedding that Friday.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
And he hasn't spoken to this guy in 5 years. He's invited to the wedding, and he attends.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's that unusual. I mean, families have falling outs, and then a big event like that will bring them together. Maybe his fiancé wanted his father to be there, or the sister did, you know.
I guess it didn't
seem like they had gotten close or anything. I mean, he left early.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The party, or the post-wedding party, the reception, that's what I'm searching for. The reception was still going on.
I would hope so, and at 7.
And he and the fiancé were gone.
Yeah, and then they left the next morning, so it's not like they were hanging around visiting.
True. So there was still probably some feelings going on there.
Probably. A neighbor would describe Dunn as arrogant, angry, and someone who's just looking for an excuse to shoot someone.
You know, I don't know how to take that.
Yeah?
I mean, that's kind of a stretch, don't you think?
Well, not considering what he did, no.
I mean, I don't know that I'd say, I could describe him if I'm a neighbor and say he's an arrogant, angry man, but I'm not sure I could jump to the conclusion that he was looking for an excuse to shoot somebody.
Well, I think he'd made comments, like, I can't wait to get some bastard or something like that along those lines. So I think there were reasons for that other than him just being unlikable. It was shocking that after the shooting, Rhonda and Michael Dunn returned to their hotel, ordered a pizza, ate dinner. They walked their puppy and went to sleep for the night by 10 p.m. Another thing during the trial is that he cried talking about their puppy, but there were no tears for Jordan Davis.
Well, yeah, because in his mind it was a justified shooting, right?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
And then amazingly, the next morning, they still hadn't contacted the police. They left Jacksonville and returned to their beachside apartment, which was 2.5 hours away in Satellite Beach, Florida.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Okay, maybe you panic and you leave the scene of the shooting. But then you get to your hotel and call the police. Or maybe you're still really wound up and you don't call them, but you certainly call them before you leave town, right?
Yeah. I mean, he had a really lame excuse that he was afraid the gang was going to be after him or something stupid. Yeah, there's no excuse for that. So it was about 24 hours after the shooting when a neighbor contacted the police. A detective called Michael Dunn and asked if he was still in Jacksonville. He said no, he was at home, but the shooting, he said, was an act of self-defense. So it's like he said, well, no big whoop. I just shot someone in self-defense. What do you want to talk to me for?
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like I was looking for trouble or anything. I just was reacting in self-defense. So you don't need to be talking to me.
Right. It's not like this person was important in any way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a real awful thing. So he was told to surrender himself to the local police, and he did do that. Police interviewed him. He described the incident, claiming that the guy in the back seat, who would be Jordan, had threatened to kill him. Now he claimed that Jordan picked up something that looked like a shotgun and said, "You're dead, motherfucker." Dunn said he continued to shoot at the SUV as it pulled away because he still felt threatened and was fearing for his fiancée's life. And he said he left the scene and stayed away out of fear. How do you feel about that? I mean, no, I hate to be totally one-sided on this, but I can't help it.
I'm just amazed that he leaves the scene. If you're claiming self-defense, you stick around and make sure that the police get your story, right?
And do you reload and shoot 10 times?
Well, you wouldn't do that to begin with.
I wouldn't think so.
But, I mean, I just can't believe he took off.
Yeah, and another thing about it is that Rhonda's story was quite different. She said that Michael Dunn expressed annoyance about the music as they pulled into the lot. He said he hated that thug music. When she heard the shooting and left the store, Rhonda was unsure of what had happened. Dunn told her to get in the car, and he put his gun back in the glove compartment as he sped away. That's like criminal behavior, it seems like it to me. Rhonda said she tried to find out what had happened. He told her he shot at the car with the music. He told her that they threatened to kill him and he feared for his life. She felt like what had happened was wrong, she would tell the police. And when they went to the hotel, she was expecting the police to show up. So that's why I kind of get the impression that she was kind of a weak person and maybe a little afraid of him.
I don't know why she wouldn't have been more pressing in getting him to call the police or turn himself in.
Right.
You know, she knew something horrible had happened.
She did. I mean, the next morning she heard on the news about the shooting and about Jordan's death, but they still went home. That is just crazy to me.
It is. Wouldn't you have liked to have been in the car with him and see what that conversation turned on?
Yeah. I just feel like he was very domineering. It's my impression.
I think it must have been that way.
Yeah. So he was placed in custody at the Brevard County Sheriff's Department. Days later, he was transported back to Jacksonville and charged with 3 counts of attempted murder and the first-degree murder of Jordan Russell Davis. He was denied bond, so he remained in jail while he was awaiting trial. Dunn pled not guilty. While he was waiting to go to trial, the case of Trayvon Martin was prominent in the news. Trayvon, you'll remember, was an unarmed African-American teenager who was shot and killed in Florida, and that was 8 months earlier. by a white neighborhood watchman, George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman had said he shot Trayvon in self-defense because he feared for his life. Now, Trayvon was not armed. These two cases became linked in the media, and there were protests across the country. So while he was in jail waiting for his trial, Michael Dunn wrote some interesting letters to family members and friends.
Yeah, he was fairly prolific in his writings.
Yes.
These are interesting. I think it gives you some insight into Michael Dunn's character.
Oh, absolutely.
So the first one, there is so much information and outright lies being reported in the media. I don't know who you've read or heard, but I wanted to assure you that I'm not the monster they're portraying me to be. My fear is that if I get a black on my jury, it will be a mistrial, as I am convinced they'll be racially biased. I'm really not prejudiced against race, but I have no use for certain cultures. This gangster rap, ghetto talking, thug culture that certain segments of society flock to is intolerable. They espouse violence and disrespect towards women. The whole community here in Jacksonville is in an uproar against me. The three other thugs that were in the car are telling stories to cover up their true colors. I'm not worried about the trial. I have the truth, and the law is on my side. After my trial, I will bring a lawsuit against the state. They will settle, and I will use the settlement for down payment on a modest house. With the rebounding economy, business will be booming, and I will use my share of the profits to buy or build our dream house on the river. I got one more. This is the best one. I don't have all the details, but an incident in December here in Jacksonville was brought to my attention. There was a confrontation of sorts at the same gas station where mine was. Black guy, white guy. The black guy pulled away from the pumps into a parking space and waited for the other vehicle to leave. Now, he followed this guy to a nearby intersection where they both stopped at a red light. Black guy got out of his vehicle, shot and killed the white guy, then drove away. After the police caught up with him, they arrested him. He was charged with second-degree murder and got out on $50,000 bond. He even had a prior arrest record to include domestic violence and alleged weapons charges. So this is one example of the reverse discrimination that appears to be rampant in the South.
So he is outraged.
Yeah.
At how he is being discriminated against.
He's been charged with first-degree murder and denied bond, and the other guy had priors, apparently,
yeah,
but still got out. So Michael Dunn is, I guess, a little pissed off.
Yeah, I think the letters speak for themselves. I don't think we have to say anything else about it.
Well, no.
No. After 2 years, Michael Dunn's trial began in February 2014. Leland and Tevin testified and admitted that Jordan did yell at Michael Dunn, but they couldn't hear what Dunn had said. A witness called by the prosecution testified that he heard Dunn say, "You're not going to talk to me that way." That statement was immediately followed by the gunshots. Michael Dunn took the stand in his defense. He described the music as ridiculously loud. He said the panels of his SUV and his side mirror were shaking.
Come on. they're not going to shake.
I don't know. Maybe, could have been a little vibration.
Maybe he can feel the bass through there, but his side view mirror is not going to be shaking.
Well, and nobody's asking him to sit there all night. This is a 2-minute stop.
I know.
Right? He said he politely asked them to turn down the music, and at first they did so, and he politely thanked them. But then he said it got ugly. He said that he overheard Jordan say, "I should kill that motherfucker." He said that he asked, "Are you talking to me?" Now, who says that? Is that Clint Eastwood?
Yeah, right?
I think so.
One of the Dirty Harry
movies. Oh, no,
are you
talking to me is Taxi Driver.
Yeah, Robert De Niro.
Right.
Yeah.
Then he saw what he thought was a shotgun barrel sticking out of the car, although he said it could have been a pipe or something. He said his main concern was the safety of who he was calling the love of his life, Rhonda. Under cross-examination, Dunn said he told Rhonda about them having a gun after they left the scene. He said he told her about the gun on the way to the hotel and several times while they were at the hotel. Now, this seemed to be kind of added on since he talked to the police. It was different than his initial interview.
Well, yeah, because he knows where things are heading. So
yeah.
He's got to have a story.
Well, yeah, I think when he went to the police the next day, he actually thought, I'm just going to explain this and go home.
Yeah.
I really think he thought that.
Sure. I'm going to go in and tell him that it was self-defense because I was fearful of my life.
Might have been a gun.
And they're going to say, thank you very much, and off I go.
I really think so, yes. So then he kind of changed his story over time to be more certain about it being a gun saying that Jordan got out of the car to shoot him, and he expanded on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He definitely did.
But there were quite a few witnesses
that contradicted his story.
Absolutely. So. And even Rhonda would end up contradicting him, which I really give her a lot of credit for that. She redeemed herself, as I said. Detectives didn't find any weapons in the SUV or anywhere near the gas station parking lot. Now, they checked the area, dumpsters, and they photographed the roof to show that it was, you know, no one threw a gun on a roof. But there was a problem because the search wasn't done until 4 days after the shooting. Detectives said they had no reason to check for a gun that night until after Michael Dunn had claimed he saw a shotgun barrel. So I think what happened here is he went in for that initial interview and didn't really talk about a gun.
Right.
So police weren't really thinking that way. 4 days seems like a long time, though. It seems to me they should have done a thorough search sooner.
Well, I think they did a search.
Yeah, but I don't think they went through dumpsters and all that.
No.
No.
Because there wasn't really any reason to.
No, because no one else said they saw a gun.
Right.
Because Rhonda didn't say that he told her he saw a gun.
And he didn't say he saw a gun, at least initially.
Right. And I think if something like that happened, or something happened where you felt threatened and you shot at someone and you're driving away, let's just give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was scared, he's driving away, wouldn't you say they had a gun pointed at me?
Yeah.
Or the kid had a gun?
Wouldn't you?
Seems like it would be one of the first things you'd say. And they drove back to the hotel. They spent the night in the hotel. They drove back to his house. And according to Rhonda, who I believe, she has no reason to lie about this, he never mentioned a gun to her in all that time.
Yeah. And her testimony turned out to be the most intriguing part of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
People were speculating about whether she would support Dunn's claims, but it was her testimony that would brand him a liar. She testified that he had never mentioned to her that he'd seen a gun. Kind of squashes that, doesn't it? So the prosecution would also dispute Dunn's testimony that Jordan was getting out of the car to shoot him, because the only way that the bullets could have struck him at the pass that they did was if he was behind the closed car door. Turns out, probably no gun.
Oh, yeah.
And he wasn't getting out of the car to confront Michael Dunn.
No, and I mean, we have to say that none of these kids had any arrest history. No one knew them to have any gang affiliation.
Yeah, these weren't thugs, as Michael Dunn would say. These were just ordinary high school kids.
Yes, that's true. It took the jury 4 days to find Michael Dunn guilty of 3 counts of attempted second-degree murder. So those are for the 3 other kids. But they couldn't reach a verdict on the first-degree murder charge. Let's talk about that a little bit. How do you decide that he was guilty of attempted second-degree murder against these other 3 he's shooting at the car, but they can't decide if he's guilty of first-degree murder against Jordan?
I have no idea how you can do that. Unless the instructions were that you either find him guilty of first-degree murder or nothing.
I think that might have been it. Maybe that was the hang-up. Because first-degree, of course, you need premeditation. But, I mean, we know from other cases, premeditation doesn't mean that you sat and plotted it out the day before.
No, it doesn't. So, again, I don't know why they couldn't reach the verdict on that first-degree charge.
Yeah, I mean, I would think reloading the gun would count as premeditation.
You would think.
But of course, after he loaded the gun, I don't think the fatal shots occurred after that. I think the fatal shots were the first 3.
The first 3.
Yeah. So maybe they were hung up on the first degree thing. Mm-hmm. That might have been it. But it was stunning to me. Of course, just for the attempted second degree murder, he got a lot of time in prison. Probably wouldn't be out because he's not a young guy.
No, he isn't.
Jordan's parents and the prosecution planned right away for a second trial. Of course, they're not letting this go. In that trial, phone calls and letters from Michael Dunn to his family members and fiancé. Now, these were used to show that he had a deep prejudice against African Americans. And I think we definitely see that in the excerpts that you read.
Yeah, and those are just a few. I mean, we could have taken a couple hours reading excerpts from letters that show his makeup.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were letters where he's talking about his fellow cellmates and people in the jail. There's a lot of racism in that, for sure.
No question. So those were kind of the excerpts that were read were just kind of the highlights of things.
Sure.
There was plenty more, believe me.
There were, and some of them are hard to read. So, yeah, we couldn't make out some of the words, and there were some that were blacked out. Now, it seems like he just saw the color of Jordan's skin, saw these black kids, and judged them to be gangsters or whatever.
Right.
And it really seems that way. So it was September 2014 when he was retried for the first-degree murder. Both sides reduced their witness lists and kind of slimmed everything down. They cut the fat on their cases. They concentrated on what they thought had worked for them in the first trial on both sides. What about Dunn testifying? Do you think that was a mistake? He testified in both of his trials.
Yeah, I'm figuring because he wanted to, because a defense attorney doesn't really want you on the stand, do they?
Not usually, although this might have been the kind of thing where he really needed to explain himself. He had some splaining to do.
Yeah, I think, but my general theory would be don't testify. There's only pitfalls in front of you when you do that.
Well, kind of makes me think that he was arrogant and he thought, well, if I talk, I can convince them.
Yeah, I think you're right.
We've known defendants that have done that in many cases we've read about.
Yep.
So the jury found him guilty. He was sentenced to life in addition to the 90 years he was serving for the attempted murders of Jordan's friends. Plus, he had gotten 15 years for shooting into an occupied dwelling, shooting into the car.
Yeah, so he's already got big-time jail time.
Yes, I mean, even with that, he probably wasn't getting out.
No.
Now, I didn't read any letters after the first conviction. I would think his attitude was quite different. I mean, we read in his first jail time, he's talking about, when I get out, I'm going back to work, I'm going to invest money, blah, blah, blah. And I would imagine after that one, he's thinking, holy shit.
Yeah, his tone would have changed, right?
And there's always the appeal process, but it wasn't looking good for him either way.
So he has a former neighbor, Charles Hendricks, who was not surprised by Dunn's behavior.
Yeah, I believe he spoke on Nancy Grace or some HLN show about this.
Yeah. Hendricks commented on Dunn, whom he described as an arrogant and controlling individual. And he also added that Dunn's ex-wives, so there's more than one ex-wife, ex-wives told him that Dunn was violent and abusive towards them, although he never personally witnessed this. Hendricks spoke of a previous discussion where Dunn asked him if he knew anyone who would take care of someone who had angered him in an unrelated incident, and Hendricks interpreted the discussion as Dunn wanting to send a hit on this person. So he sounds like a sweetheart, doesn't he?
Awful. Jordan's parents became outspoken activists all after all this happened, and they started the Jordan Davis Foundation. So the mission of the Jordan Davis Foundation, it's a nonprofit organization, and they provide financial assistance for the youth of our nation to nurture their curiosity with exposure to cultural initiatives through travel and education. In January 2015, the documentary, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, premiered at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. The documentary is about the shooting, the trial, and about Florida's Stand Your Ground laws. This was directed by a well-known director, Mark Silver. The documentary won the U.S. Documentary Special Jury Award for Social Impact at the Sundance Film Festival. And then the film was distributed and sold to HBO, and we watched it.
We did. Fascinating, chilling documentary.
Yes.
So following the trial, Dunn's attorney filed for appeal with the First District Court of Appeal for the state of Florida. And on November 2016, his appeal was denied. And his fiancée, Rhonda, is no longer engaged to him.
Well, good for her.
And, well, do we have anything? Is he appealing again? Or
I think the latest appeal...
I'm sure he is.
The latest appeal that I heard about was the one in November 2016.
Okay.
But I don't think his chances of getting out are very good.
No, they aren't. But from his standpoint, he feels like he was terribly wronged and he's going to keep on appealing, right?
Do you think he really feels that way or is he just saying that?
Oh, no.
He really feels that way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
That's
okay.
Worse.
Let's just figure he's this racist creep.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can do that.
But he still feels it's a justified shooting. And he shouldn't be in jail.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So tell me, Jill, what do you think of this stand your ground law?
Well, of course I'm against it. I don't even think anyone should have a gun. I mean, I'm totally on the other side of this.
You're totally across the border on that.
But the fact that you don't have to retreat, to me, is outrageous. If you can retreat and save yourself, why wouldn't you do that? Why would you want to stand there and kill somebody?
Well, that's my whole issue with it. It seems to me that it gives you license to be an aggressor.
Right.
And you can say, well, I thought I was going to be harmed.
And it kind of sets up these types of situations.
It does. I mean, here we have two within several months of each other, just in the state of Florida.
Well, and I'm far more outraged. Well, maybe not far more, but I'm more outraged with Trayvon Martin. He's walking around outside with a soda and a bag of Skittles.
He's doing nothing.
And George Zimmerman was following him.
Yeah.
Going after him.
Well, and there's been...
And he was not convicted.
Since this, there's been other kids.
Of course.
Black teenagers that have been shot and killed.
There are outrageous stories. I mean, even by police.
Yeah.
It's so sad. I mean, I feel like if you're an African-American parent, if you have a son especially, how do you raise that kid? You'd have to raise him to be very defensive and fearful, really.
You do. You know, you have to be non-confrontational. Otherwise, you get shot.
I think it goes beyond non-confrontational. Like, you have to, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? I mean, you really have to almost bow down to people to avoid being hurt.
Yeah.
So it's a horrible situation to be in.
It is. I think it's a shitty law.
Yeah, I think so.
And there's a lot of states that have it as law.
I think it's setting these kind of shootings up to happen.
Yeah.
In shootings, like, there was one where a college kid, I think, went into the wrong house because he was super drunk, and he was shot and killed. Now, in someone's house, I guess people are going to say that's different.
Yeah, I'm not sure I like that example.
But I feel like if someone comes into my house, I have another exit. I can go out another door and call the police. I don't need to shoot him.
Well, you don't. That's true.
But I realize I'm on the far end from a lot of people.
You could be.
I could be, but I do feel like stand your ground is... really allowed some outrageous things and tragic things to happen.
I don't think there's any question.
So obviously we're not going to solve this, but it's definitely a discussion that more people are having and should be having. I know that Jordan's mother would like to do something about the Stand Your Ground law.
Well, good for her.
Yeah.
I think it needs to be looked at.
Well, before we head right into feedback, I'd like to remind our listeners who aren't TIGRABBER members that hey, it might be something you're interested in. TIGRABBER members are our primary support for our podcasts. We recently released an episode of The Craigslist Killer, Philip Markoff, that I'm really proud of. I think we did a good job on it. We consistently release a members-only episode at least once a month, and we put just as much effort into these episodes as we do into our primary episodes. You can join for as little as $3 a month up to $5 a month by going to our website, tigrabber.com. Our members will receive a TCB gift from us and our undying admiration, which is far more valuable. If you're interested, sign up at tigrabber.com or support us on Patreon, and you can listen to these premium episodes there as a patron. You can also support us by making a purchase of a t-shirt or a snifter or a bottle opener, several different things through our Shop the Brewery page on our website. Also, we would love to get a positive review from you on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast.
Yeah, we really dig those reviews.
They're important because they get more people to listen.
That's right.
Our Design a True Crime Brewery t-shirt contest is still on for another 2 weeks, so please get your entry into us at truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com or through a direct message on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. Now, shocking news, we're taking the first week of February off. So there will be a week without a TCB episode. I know, it's going to be tough.
It will be.
So this is our first break since we began podcasting in May 2016.
Right, so it's almost 2 years.
Yeah.
With uninterrupted episodes.
Yeah, and what we've done is we have taken vacations, but then we've had to work our asses off the week before to get two and have them ready to release. So it's a well-deserved break.
I think it is, and it's just 1 week.
Yeah. It's going to be tough for me. I'm going to feel like, oh, my God.
You'll probably suffer withdrawal.
I know, because it's really the podcast is an everyday thing for me. I'm always doing something with it. So this will be good. As always, we welcome your feedback, and I would really like to hear from our listeners. Our listeners are, for the most part, very smart people, and your input really adds to the quality of True Crime Brewery. Crime fascinates me, and I think Dick's getting more into it lately, because a lot of these cases he never heard of, because he was not a true crime follower until I got him into it. And he seems like he's getting more involved in it.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is that I'm gearing up for retirement when I'm going to be doing this more full-time with you.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. If you don't want to write in and have your opinions discussed on a future episode in feedback, you can definitely share your opinions, experiences, anything on our True Crime Brewery fan discussions page on Facebook. We have amazing listeners who run that page and write great stuff. I go on it once every 1 or 2 weeks. I don't get on it that often, but I do get on it, and I'm always impressed with the things that people are writing. So let's do a little feedback.
Okay.
And then we'll wrap it up.
Let's do that.
All right, I'm going to start, if that's okay.
You go right ahead.
Okay. So from Laura A., I have a case suggestion. Over the last year, I've started to get into true crime podcasts, and I stumbled across yours while I was searching for a new one to listen to on my commute to work. I was drawn to it because I'm also an avid beer fan, and the name of the podcast caught my attention. I have to say now, I basically only listen to your podcasts. I love it. I love everything from the cases you discuss to the beer reviews, and especially the banter between you two. So I guess I didn't need to read all that, but it's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is.
I wanted to recommend a case to you that I don't think you've covered before. It's the Kate Waring case from Charleston, South Carolina. Have you heard of it? I think we've seen it on Dateline. Kate was a sorority sister of mine at UNC, so I have a personal connection to the case, but I also think it's one that your listeners would find intriguing. Thank you for considering this case. So Kate Waring, she went to the gym, a drugstore, and dinner at a Japanese steakhouse with friends, and then she disappeared. And this was in the evening. So she was a well-to-do woman from her family in Charleston, South Carolina, but she'd had drug problems in the past. But it didn't look like she'd had a relapse. Her mom said she'd vanished without her clothes or her daily medicine.
What daily medicine?
I think antidepressants, perhaps.
Okay.
I'm not sure. When her father, Thomas Waring, filed for a missing persons report, he said something strange had happened between his daughter and two friends, Ethan Mack and Heather Camp. She was scared of the pair, but the dad didn't say why. So I think, if you remember the dateline, she met this Heather Camp on a train, and they became really close, and this Heather Camp turned out to be a big con woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ringing a bell.
It vaguely is ringing
yeah.
a bell.
So Kate's body was found in a rural area of a gated community. Police found their story of the night kept changing after she disappeared. They also found out that they had forged a check on her account for $4,500 3 days after she went missing. They were charged with forgery and obstruction of justice. It turns out Camp was familiar to the police elsewhere. She'd been accused of robbery in California and did time in Indianapolis, and she was wanted in two other states. So yeah, Laura, I think that our listeners would like that case, and I'm going to probably do that in the future.
We love Southern cases anyway.
Because of the beer?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's my reason.
Yeah, okay.
And Charleston's one of my favorite cities. So yeah, let's do that.
All right. Thanks, Laura.
Okay, I've got one from Evo8 Rich called Shell Casings Are Not a Thing. So this is a quick note from Evo8 Rich. It says, I discovered your channel last week and I love it. And I'm also a fellow YouTuber. I'm working my way up from your older to your newest podcasts. And I'm also a gunsmith. And as Dick probably knows, when you have knowledge on something, it kind of drives you nuts when you keep hearing the wrong term being used. When it comes to a shell, there's no such thing as a shell casing. It is called a case or cases, if there's more than one. The term casing is a TV thing, and it's wrong.
Okay.
I mean, no disrespect whatsoever. I just want to give you some info, just like you guys do for us.
Well, yeah, it's good to know. I don't want to keep saying something that's incorrect, so I appreciate that.
So we're not going to say shell casing. We're just going to say a case.
Casings. Case.
Case or cases in the plural.
Not casings.
Not casings.
All right.
Okay.
What did we say about Jordan? Did we say they found casings or cases?
We said shell casings, probably.
Probably.
Because we weren't informed.
Right.
So thank you, Evil
I have no gun knowledge.
But now we're going to use the correct term and say case in the singular or cases in the plural.
Okay. You keep on me about that. If I make the mistake, you let me know.
I'll jump on you.
Okay. So a comment from Tearbag about Gypsy Rose Blanchard. To this woman on the podcast, I'm a pediatrician and I have been involved in Munchausen by proxy cases. It is extremely difficult to detect when this is happening. These parents are extremely skillful at fooling us. Much of what we do is based on history, not testing, and it's the nature of our business. I'm going to let you talk about it, Dick, but I think in the podcast and in other podcasts about Munchausen by proxy, we have been critical of the medical community.
We have, probably because we know the whole story and not just pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this doctor is correct. It is a difficult thing to diagnose when you're in the midst of it. But if you can get a good history and find out that the child's had umpteen number of surgeries and how many doctor visits you can't even count, that's something you'd think about.
Well, I think in this case, they moved frequently.
Yeah.
And they didn't know.
Well, you're right.
Yeah.
They didn't know. And they had the story of the records being destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. So it is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be suspicious. And that's not the nature of people, right?
Right, yeah. That's true. I guess what really struck out in that case to me was it the neurologist who saw that her legs were not atrophied at all, even though she was supposedly not able to walk?
Yeah, I think in Gypsy's case, the neurologist took some heat.
Yeah, he kind of dropped the ball there, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he actually considered that as a part of it, as a diagnosis.
Right.
But didn't report it.
Yes.
So.
I think he wrote it in his notes, but what good does that do if it doesn't go anywhere?
I'm not going there.
I would just think.
I would, or I will. I mean, he put it in his notes to cover his ass.
Just in case.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, because the thing is, though, if that's something you're considering, then you should necessarily be reporting it because you don't have to know of something to report
you're
it.
You're obligated to report it.
Right.
Anyway.
So that's.
But yeah, I think going back to the original statement, it's not an easy diagnosis.
Sure. I don't think most doctors are there, you know, thinking that parents want to hurt their children.
Right.
It's not normal.
And the typical pediatrician will probably never see a case of Munchausen by proxy.
Really? It's that rare?
It's pretty rare.
Huh. Okay. Or maybe not to that extreme. Maybe there are milder cases where people just want to get a little attention.
We could amend that a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty rare disorder.
But are there like non-life-threatening ones where like parents just complain that their kid has vomiting all the time or something?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But whether that's Munchausen by proxy is a tough diagnosis.
Or if it's just like paranoia or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or hypochondria.
Yeah.
In the parent.
It's hard to determine that, I guess.
It is.
And it's not like you have all day to concentrate on one patient. I mean, the way healthcare is going now, it's like quantity over quality.
Well, yeah. You need to see the patients.
Yeah.
Get them in and out.
Right. That's true. That's how everything's going. Okay. Well, thank you, Tearbag. Nice to hear from another pediatrician.
Yeah. Keep listening.
Yeah.
I have one from Bass13 Mary. It's a comment on a mom on death row, Darlie Rudier.
Yeah.
We keep hearing about her.
This case always pops up.
Yep. So Bass13 Mary says, three kids. One disabled, autistic, retarded, now going blind with massive GI bleeds. And at the beginning, we were dirt poor. I grew up a very posh family, but still my dad did it on your own like I did. Never did I think of offing my children. By the way, three kids by age 30, went back to university, became a teacher, got my master's. Didn't pull a Darlie.
So I thought that was kind of a cool email.
It was.
Kind of saying how rough she's had it, or is it a woman, you think? Mary,
I think so.
So maybe. How rough she's had it and how she overcame it and never thought to kill her kids.
Never even entered her mind to
right.
kill her kids.
Yeah, and I think that would be, for most of us, that would be the case. But I give her credit.
Oh.
Yeah.
She's got a good spirit, don't you think?
I think so. Yep, it's excellent. So I have a comment on the baby thief. The story of Georgia Tan from Hope Parker. And Hope says, try looking into the modern-day child kidnappings called CPS, Child Protective Services, Adoption and Family Court. If you think that this type of child kidnapping died with Georgia Tan, you haven't researched those three agencies. So, sure, I don't think that it died with Georgia Tan.
No, I don't think we said that, did we?
No, I don't think it did. I think
it takes different guises, but it still exists.
And it's probably not as prominent.
Right.
I don't think it's as corrupt as it was.
I don't think it is.
But it is fascinating the way that she shaped a lot of the current day adoption laws. So with CPS, they could take a child and, you know, you kind of lose a lot of power there about what they're going to do with your child.
CPS can take your child and terminate your rights.
Yeah. It's a lot of power.
Yes.
That I'm sure could be abused.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thanks, Hope. I think you're definitely right about that.
Okay. Another one. I have one from Queen Bee. And then there were none. The story of the Beaumont children. So Queen Bee says, this stranger danger thing. Yes, sometimes a stranger does snatch a child. But what most people forget is that the vast, vast, vast majority of violence, sexual, physical abuse of children is committed by someone they know. More emphasis needs to be placed on ensuring all children know they must tell a trusted adult if someone tries to hurt them or does hurt them, no matter what the threat the perpetrator has given them.
So how do you feel about that?
It's a no-brainer, of course.
Yeah.
No, I think when you look at that, stranger abductions are pretty rare, or stranger abuse. It's a family member or someone that's known to the child.
I think that's well known, yeah.
And I think we need to keep on getting them, the children, trying to get them to report things to the parents.
So is this something they're doing in school now, do you know, from seeing kids? Is this, I mean, our kids are adults, and I know there really wasn't anything in the school back then.
They are. I don't know how deeply they go into it, but they talk about stranger danger.
Which isn't really the big problem, is what she's saying.
I know.
But isn't there this whole thing of, you know, good touching, bad touching? Is that in the schools? Or did the alt-right say no to that?
No, it's in the schools.
Okay.
But it's also stuff that's discussed during checkups in the pediatrician's office.
Oh, okay. At every age?
Different ages, not every single age.
Okay. So certain ages that are mapped out, that this is something you ask at this age.
Mm-hmm.
And that's determined by the American Academy of Pediatrics?
AAP.
Yeah.
Primarily.
Yeah, I often wonder, and I know you know this, if a kid's parent is in the room with them, how do you know the kid's being honest? I mean, what if the parent that's in the room with them is the abusing parent?
Well, I guess you have to read into things a little bit, right?
I suppose, but that can be tough.
It can be. I there's no easy way to answer that, because if it's a four-year-old kid, of course the parent's going to be in the room with them.
Exactly.
So you just have to look for maybe nonverbal clues.
Are pediatricians trained to do that, though?
They are.
Oh, good. That's good. That's reassuring. Well, I know I've made comments with teenagers, or even like, 17, 18-year-olds? Their mom comes in with them?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that drives me crazy. I don't understand that. Because how can you talk to a kid about birth control, things like that, drug use with their parent there? How can you get an honest answer?
Well, I don't know.
Of course, you can't ban the parent from coming in, I guess.
You can't. I mean, my personal method is if a parent's in with an older child, I ask the child if it's okay if the parent stays in with them.
In front of the parent, you say that?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're there.
Right.
And if they say yes, I say fine. I still ask the same questions.
Sure.
Realizing that I might not get the honest answer.
Right.
But sometimes I do.
Yeah.
And the majority of parents, once the kids hit 15 or so, stay out anyway.
That's good. But I think the offending parent is the parent that's going to be in the room and the parent that the kid will be afraid to speak up.
They can be.
Yeah.
I mean, and if it's me and the child with the parent out in the waiting room, I always emphasize that what the child and I discuss is between just us.
Yeah.
And it's not reported to the parent.
That's good.
So.
Okay. Well, I could go on and on because that fascinates me, but I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay. So I have another comment on the Gypsy Rose Blanchard case, and this is someone very supportive of Gypsy, and it's Coco Ka is her. I think this was a YouTube comment. The girl is 100% innocent and a true hero to step up to her evil mother. The boyfriend is not innocent. In fact, he was just using this poor girl just like her mother did. The girl deserves to walk free after all she lost. She lost her childhood to that monster, being humiliated all of her life. That's truly disgusting. And her mother got what she deserved. Those are strong words.
They are.
I wouldn't say that anyone deserves to be stabbed to death. So I think
no.
I wouldn't go that far. But I do think after a certain amount of punishment, rehabilitation, something, she should definitely have a chance at a life.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, look at the life she's leading.
Right. And she didn't actually kill her mother. Now, I know planning a murder can be just as bad, but in her situation, I think a lot of that could be forgiven.
Okay. I mean, I don't want you stepping into the needing to die or anything like that.
Oh, no. I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm just saying she didn't really see any other pathway out, which there were other pathways, but I believe she didn't see it.
Perhaps. Okay, I have a note from Cammy Thompson about Andrea Yates.
Oh, okay.
The postpartum psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a quickie. She's kind of critical of Rusty. Rusty kept on getting her pregnant like it's no big deal. He should have stopped at 3 children, not 5. She's not a rabbit. Andrea was pregnant with the 6th child, but the baby died. It was a miscarriage.
That I didn't know. Did we know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
The more kids she has, the more stress and other issues she had at the time. So.
And she obviously suffered from postpartum depression, so with every pregnancy.
Every pregnancy made things worse.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's something that I think we'd all agree on.
Yeah, I mean, I do blame Rusty a lot. I also blame the religious things, that couple that they were hanging out with, and yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was definitely a religious backdrop to why they were having all these children.
Well, I'm not going there.
Okay. So I have...
Get me talking on that.
I have another case recommendation. This is from Alana. I'm recommending the Robert Chambers case, known as the Preppy Murder.
Yeah, that's a very famous murder.
He left Jennifer Levin dead in New York City's Central Park, legs spread, blouse pulled up to her neck. And when he was discovered, he claimed it was self-defense due to her rough sex rape attempt. She's 5'4", 110 pounds. He was 6'4", 220 pounds. Based on his story, the media crucified Levin, so the victim, referred to her small notebook as a sex diary, and he almost got away with this crime. This was before the rape shield laws, which her mother helped to inaugurate, along with victims' rights advocacy. Starts in 1986, trial in 1988. He got a plea deal, 5 to 15 years, but serves all 15 due to his ongoing misbehavior. Attacking guards, there was heroin hidden in his cell, weapons charges, etc. He was released in 2003, and he would be charged with drug infractions, and in 2008 charged with drug trafficking and sentenced to 19 years. Yes, he has quite a past history before killing Jennifer Levin, another golden child, and another angelic-looking culprit, like Scott Peterson, OJ in the early days, etc. And another case of a victim being treated worse than the offender. That's true. I mean, Nicole Brown Simpson was really treated like crap.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She was this coke-addicted, promiscuous, horrible woman.
Right. Lots more details that you both are good at bringing out. Thanks, Alana. I don't know that Lacey Peterson was made to look bad, though. I mean, there really wasn't anything you could do to make her look bad. She seemed like such a good person.
That's true.
Yeah. Plus, she was like 8 months pregnant.
Right.
Yeah. But Scott Peterson did kind of have the good guy image, which really reminds me of Robert Chambers. I think I've seen pictures of him. They're both kind of these preppy, white, white bread guys.
Intelligent, good looking, athletic.
Yeah.
Right.
Golden
schools.
Child.
Yeah.
Is there a syndrome called the golden child? Because I see that. Maybe we should label it a syndrome.
I don't know. We could do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Alana.
I got a case suggestion from Surftas. This is about a dog mauling case. Interesting case. I didn't remember that it was that long ago.
When was it?
2001.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a long time ago.
So please consider reporting on the dog mauling case in San Francisco, whereby two Prisa Canarios, that's a dog breed, attacked and killed lacrosse coach Diane Whipple. This case involves many controversial issues and bizarre twists and turns. The best reference that I have read on the subject is Red Zone by Aphrodite Jones. We like reading her. Read a couple of other crime stories by her.
Yeah, she does a good job getting right to the point of things.
Yeah. So Diane Alexis Whipple was a lacrosse player and a college coach. She was killed in a dog attack in San Francisco on January 26, 2001. The dogs involved were two Prisa Canarios, a male named Bane and a female named Hera. The owner of the dogs, Paul Schneider, was a high-ranking member of the Aryan Brotherhood, and he was serving a life sentence in a state prison.
When
the attack happened.
Oh, so who was in charge of the dogs?
The dogs were cared for by Schneider's husband and wife attorneys, Robert Noel and Marjorie Noller. They lived in the same apartment building as Diane Whipple. So after the fatal attack, the state brought criminal charges against these two attorneys. Robert Noel, who was not present during the attack, was convicted of manslaughter. Marjorie Noller, who was present, was charged with implied malice, second-degree murder, and convicted. So Noller's murder conviction, which was unusual for an unintended dog attack, was rejected by the trial judge, but ultimately upheld. So the case clarified the meaning of implied malice murder. So this whole thing was that the attorneys knew that these were vicious dogs and dangerous to people, mm-hmm. and they still kept them and still exposed them to other people. So it was,
and they were loose.
I think this occurred in the hallway of the apartment building.
Right, so they were loose in the hallway.
I don't know if they were loose or on leashes, but they attacked and killed this woman.
Well, how would they attack if they were on leashes?
You've seen these dogs? They're big dogs.
They're big dogs,
You're not going to pull them off of somebody.
Well, yeah, that's sad.
I think the whole thing was that these people knew that these were dangerous dogs.
And then I imagine the dogs were put down.
I would imagine.
I would.
An interesting case. Let's look at it.
I think it is. I think it's different than anything we've ever done.
Yeah.
So I really would like to do that.
Okay.
All right.
Add that to your list.
Okay. So I just have one more piece of feedback. This is from The Hermit's Perspective, and this is on the murder of Sean Desher. One of the most disturbing cases we've ever covered.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just a horrible, horrible crime. They tortured this poor girl for a day or two and burned her after she's dead.
I actually felt bad. A lot of listeners said they had trouble listening to it. And I really feel like we edited a lot of it out. We were less graphic than we could have been.
I think we were. We could have been worse.
So anyway, The Hermit's Perspective says, I'm from their town. One of the girls was released yesterday. 2-3 weeks back, someone told us that there was a possibility that Lori Tackett was getting out in January, and we couldn't find it. And we're like, well, we don't know about that. She's, you know, she got a 60-year sentence. We thought she'd be in longer. But I did find the article saying, woman guilty of 1992 torture and killing of Sean Desher is released. So Lori Tackett has been released.
Interesting.
Yep, so she's the third of four teenagers convicted in this killing, and she's released from prison. She is only 43. She still has some life ahead of her. She was released from Rockville Correctional Facility early morning last Thursday. Her release was 26 years to the date from when 12-year-old Sean Desher was killed. So she was sentenced in 1993 to a 60-year sentence for the murder and a related charge of criminal confinement, labeled a Class B felony at the time. So she'll have 2 years of parole, and that'll be it. She was 17 when the murder occurred. She was the oldest of the four girls. They were all charged as adults. Hope Rippey and Tony Lawrence, who were both 15, are already released from prison.
Yeah, there's only the one left.
But one of those two girls, the 15-year-olds, one of them sprayed Windex on her or something, participated.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah.
The other one was less involved.
Well, she mostly just didn't tell anyone, was her main thing.
Yeah.
So they've both been out, and Melinda Lovelace is still in prison, although she was given the same sentence as Tackett. But it says she won't be eligible for release until 2019, which isn't that long. But I don't know. I mean, I heard that Melinda Lovelace was doing really good things in prison.
Right. But she's the only one left.
Yeah. And I had thought that Lori Tackett was kind of the more aggressive of the two. So it kind of surprises me.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, in 2008, Lovelace did file a motion to have her conviction overturned, based on the fact that she was a minor when it happened and she was too young to understand, and that she had been coerced, but that did not fly.
Nope.
So 3 out of 4 are out. It looks like in a couple of years, Melinda will be out.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, a year or two.
Okay.
So that's kind of surprising to me.
It is.
Yeah. Okay.
But,
well,
I mean, again, they're juveniles. Maybe they've learned something.
Let's hope so.
Right.
Yeah. Let's hope so. Okay, thanks for the discussion, Dick.
Thanks, and Julie.
Thanks, everybody, for your feedback, and we will see you at the Quiet End.
Join us there.
Bye-bye.
Bye.